You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Farad. Coming up, veteran suicides have gone up in recent years. A Wisconsin organization has a unique approach to suicide prevention.
But first, stories of people our next guest calls the heroically frugal have been making the rounds during the Great Recession and its aftermath. People like Canada's Sean Cooper, who paid off a $250,000 mortgage by eating Kraft mac and cheese for dinner and living in the basement of his own home, used to generate positive responses, but that may be changing.
Our next guest says that the narrative that our financial woes are no one's fault but our own may be shifting. As housing prices climb, the economy works to recover lost ground. Maybe, she says, people are realizing there's only so much that budgeting can accomplish.
Helene Olin joins us now. She's a columnist for Slate and the author of Pound Foolish, co-author of The Index Card. Helene, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thank you for having me on.
Well, can you start by telling us the story of Sean Cooper? This is a Canadian guy who paid off that $255,000 mortgage in 3 years.
Yes, I can. This is a fantastic story. Sean Cooper, who is, among other things, a personal finance blogger, bought a house a few years ago in a suburb of Toronto, or in the Toronto suburbs, I should say, and he decided he did not want to keep a mortgage, in part because his mother had almost lost the family home when he was a child. And so he basically devoted his life for several years to paying down that mortgage and did it successfully. But when I say devoted his life to it, I mean he did three jobs, worked 90 hours a week, and paid off this mortgage. And then he decided to invite the CBC to film him burning his mortgage papers, you know, the traditional thing people used to do, right, when they paid off their mortgage. And everybody apparently thought this would be a great feel-good story. What nobody counted on was what happened next, which is the fact that a lot of Canadians didn't think this was a particularly feel-good story. They thought they were being hectored, and they were being told that they should emulate Sean Cooper and work 90 hours a week. And people began writing in comments to the CBC along the lines of, you know, they have labor laws for this reason. Didn't you know that? And so on.
So this sounds like a shift, right? Because this is the kind of story, it seems like, that during the Great Recession, when belt tightening especially was really big, people were going on their own personal austerity, budget, dietary sort of thing. It seemed like this is what people wanted to hear. We got into this mess. We have to get out of it ourselves. So what's the shift here?
Well, I think the shift is a couple of things. As I like to say, in a lot of ways, this stuff is catnip during a recession, right? You give people the means to control the situation. The personal finance guru Dave Ramsey once said, you can choose not to participate in a recession, right? So you have this idea that people are frittering away their money on little things, the so-called latte factor, right? And, you know, if you can stop it, you will be okay. The shift is that people begin to realize at a certain point that that is not really the case, that these are greater economic forces pounding away at them. In Canada, for instance, like in many cities here, Toronto is experiencing a huge real estate run-up. People are finding the homes increasingly unaffordable. They also had recently come out of a recession, and people were pretty furious. Their savings rates have fallen as well. And I should say, this happened during the Great Depression here in the United States as well.
Right. You write about the thrift movement throughout history. Where did that idea of being thrifty, being such a virtue, come from?
Well, I mean, we've always, you know, people always admire thrift, right? But the idea of thrift really blew up during the First Gilded Age, if you consider our age the Second Gilded Age. And people would lecture at immigrants, thinking they were living in tenements, not because they were poor, but because they didn't know how to manage money. So they would offer them money management classes at settlement houses and so on. People published books on thrift. And what eventually happened is this crash lands into the Great Depression. And the entire thrift movement essentially winds down over a couple of years, with one person who was huge in it actually claiming there was no use talking thrift to people who had nothing to be thrifty with.
Do you think that we're in a comparable thrift moment here in the United States, and are we possibly moving out of it?
Well, I should emphasize, Sean Cooper is Canadian, right? But it is possible. I mean, we are seeing signs, right? There is the Fight for 15 movement, which is increasingly gaining steam. This recognition that people are having financial issues, not because they can't budget properly, but because the minimum wage has failed to keep up with where it was relative to inflation in the 1970s. You're also seeing pushback. There was a survey that came out this past week from a market research group, I believe in New York, America's Research Group, that said 20% of shoppers simply can't afford to shop, which is astonishing when you think about that.
Well, in the meantime, there has been in our country, there's been this big appetite to hear from people like Suze Orman and Dave Ramsey about how they can get control of their financial lives. Do you have any sense that maybe people are getting impatient with that message?
I think they are getting impatient with that message. A few years ago, I did a piece on Dave Ramsey's attitude towards bankruptcy, which, as you might or might not know, he's very anti-bankruptcy, despite the fact that he himself filed for it at one point in his life. And I went to the webpage on his own website, and he wrote in about why you should consider bankruptcy only as a real last resort and how this is a really hard thing and, you know, really you should be paying down your bills. And people literally wrote into the website about how bankruptcy had made their lives better and that, you know, they had just given up on paying down bills that they could not afford to pay. And keep in mind, the main reason for bankruptcy in this country is health care costs. It's not people overspending at Starbucks.
So do you think in this country and in Canada, as we were talking about, people are shifting to look at some of these bigger systemic things, things like income inequality, housing costs, the economy, which is still slowly sputtering back to life? Are people looking at that instead of kind of kicking themselves around the block?
I think people are doing both, I think, is the answer. You know, a lot of these things aren't either or. I think there is a sense that people, an increasing sense among many people, that no matter how virtuous they are, no matter how good they are with money, they're not going to be able to keep up. And in some ways, this is a correct take on their part. Median household income adjusted for inflation is down still 7% from 2000. At the same time, as we all know, the cost of housing, health care, and education has gone up at rates well above inflation now for many years. To take one particular example that always leaps out at me, if you have employer-provided health insurance, that is, you know, you get health insurance through your employer, your out-of-pocket costs have gone up by over 50% since 2010, which is an extraordinary number that should actually get a lot more attention from people.
And we've got this presidential election year. You know, we're in the midst of this right now. How big a deal do you think all of these financial factors, you've mentioned the Fight for 15, that's the minimum wage movement, income inequality. How big a deal do you think issues like that are going to be in the presidential election?
Well, it seems like they've turned into a rather big deal at this point. Think about just last week, Hillary Clinton came out and said that she supported free in-state college tuition for students coming from households with incomes of less than $125,000 annually. And that's likely in part because of the huge millennial support for Bernie Sanders, who, as we all know, campaigned on a promise to try to make public college free for all students. And that's because the cost of college, again, is surging at rates beyond inflation over the entire period since the Great Recession.
If you look back through the lens of history and you see where we are with all of the economic issues that you just outlined there, do you see any corollaries from the past that might tell us where we're going to be headed next?
I try not to predict the future. but what I would say is it does seem that hard economic times seem to ultimately result in people attempting to push forward and realize when they realize, as I think I put it in this article, that they've kind of been had to an extent, right? That they're not going to save their way out of this, and they need the help of the greater economy and the greater society to get through.
And Helene, we started with the story of the Canadian man who paid down his mortgage in 3 years, you know, through extreme measures. And you recently spoke in Canada. What did people there have to say about this piece? Because I know this was a big piece of reporting that you did, especially in Canada. What did people tell you?
Well, you see both sides of it, right? I mean, some people really do admire what he did, and it was a real achievement. I should say that, right? I do believe it was a real achievement doing that. But a lot of other people just seem to be fairly annoyed that this was presented to them as some sort of model for how they should financially live, that this, you know, extreme sacrifice would A, work, and B, pay off. As many pointed out, he doesn't have Sean Cooper is a lovely person, but he's in his 20s. He doesn't have children. He's not married. So in one way, it's rather easy for him to go work 90 hours a week and put all his money towards his mortgage. He doesn't have a family to support. And people were very open about saying that.
Now, when you look at how all of these issues might play out in this country, what are the flashpoints as you look ahead this year and during the presidential race?
I think the flashpoints are people's salaries have simply not kept up with their greater expenses, that child care is a huge and enormous expense for many families, that health care continues to be a huge and enormous expense for many families, that the cost of higher education continues to be a huge and growing expense for many families, and that housing is, in many areas of the country, extremely expensive, that rents have surged in the wake of the Great Recession. It's just not just housing prices. And that these are all putting enormous strains on households, and that people want help. They want the problems solved, and they expect politicians to deal with it.
Helene, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Helene Olin, columnist for Slate and the author of Pound Foolish. She's also currently the host of the podcast The United States of Debt. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, if you've seen people walking around staring at their phones, it might be because of the new Pokemon Go app, but the new popular game has some security concerns. We'll find out more coming up.
First, among Americans of all ages, more than half of all suicides are gun suicides. And according to a recent New York Times article, the suicide rate among veterans has surged 35% since 2001, driven in part by sharp increases among those who have served since 2001. Many veterans own personal firearms and are comfortable using them.
A Wisconsin nonprofit is trying to prevent veteran suicides by reminding the former service member that they have a lot to live for. Joining us now is the director and co-founder of Cover Me Veterans, Heidi Sigmund. She's a psychologist who works with veterans diagnosed with PTSD. Heidi, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having us.
Also with us, Sergeant Ryan Bodwin, United States Marine Corps, who served in the infantry from 1999 to 2006. He was deployed to Iraq in 2004 and 2005. Sergeant Bodwin, thanks a lot to you as well.
Oh, thank you.
Well, Heidi, let's start by talking about the problem here. Suicide apparently on the increase among veterans in the United States, especially for people deployed in our wars of the last couple of decades. Is that something that you are seeing that's a concern as you work with veterans here in Wisconsin?
Absolutely. We are definitely finding this to be a struggle. Many people are very aware of the number 22, as in we're losing 22 veterans per day to suicide. But in some respects, the number is quite misleading because we are losing actually probably closer to 20, but that's because we're losing veterans, older veterans from the Korean War, from World War II. So the rate of suicide is actually increasing, although the number, according to more recent research, shows it might be going down in number per day.
And Ryan, what is it about the most recent conflicts that may be contributing to this rising suicide rate among veterans of wars like Iraq and Afghanistan?
Honestly, that's hard to say. I think it's been a problem since the Korean War, even maybe before that, before we kept statistics. But it's an issue. We're aware of it now. Like Heidi said, the 22 was brought about by some other organizations that were veteran-run and or run by civilian patriots, trying to bring awareness to the issue of 22, and now we're doing something about it.
And let's talk about what this effort, Heidi, is doing about veteran suicide. Cover Me Veterans. What exactly is this new initiative? What are you doing that's hoping to bring down the suicide rate?
Yeah, so it was actually a simple idea with great power and impact, I think. And it was born from a concept that was simply working for me in my own practice, both with veterans and civilians. But as you mentioned, I treat vets with PTSD, and many of them struggle with chronic suicidal thoughts. You know, whenever someone mentions having suicidal thoughts, one of our first goals is to encourage them to temporarily restrict their access to firearms, much like we would encourage someone who's had too much to drink to hand their car keys over temporarily. But in the veteran population, it's a bit of a challenge because firearms are a part of their culture, their identity. They're comfortable using them. I would say, actually, sometimes their anxiety might even go up if they hand them over to someone else. If we add on to that the impulsivity of attempts, a lot of people don't realize, but many, many attempts occur within 5 minutes of the decision to actually attempt suicide. Up to a quarter of attempts occur within that time. So if means are available, we have a very dangerous situation, and we need to find a way to intervene. So what I was doing in my own practice was simply to encourage veterans, if they were not willing to hand over their firearms temporarily, to rubber band pictures of something that was relevant and personally meaningful to them, something that gave their life purpose. So they were willing to do that readily. It didn't change the accessibility of the firearm, and they would report back that this was really working for them. So I shared this with a Marine friend of mine, and he encouraged me to really try to do more with this because you know, I'm listening to the veterans, and they're telling me it's working, which is most important to me.
And so on their firearm, they have rubber banded, and now with this new thing, it's gotten fancier than that, but there's a picture of something, someone they love, something that might give them pause in that impulsive moment, that moment where they might be ready to kill themselves, to shoot themselves. That is enough, this one picture, Heidi, to maybe make them put off that decision, get past that dark moment.
That's absolutely the idea. We realize, you know, this is not going to work for everyone, but it's certainly, per the report of people I've worked with and other veterans I've consulted with, it is working for some and has the potential to make a difference and to intervene.
We're talking about the Cover Me Veterans effort based here in Wisconsin, run by volunteers. Heidi Sigmund is with us, psychologist. She works with veterans. Sergeant Ryan Bodwin from the United States Marine Corps, veteran of the deployment to Iraq himself. This effort, it puts pictures of loved ones, things to live for, the effort trying to prevent suicide among veterans. Ryan, I wanted to ask you, as a veteran, is this something you hear from your colleagues, that they've had that moment where they were contemplating suicide?
Absolutely. I mean, it happens more than you think. I've struggled with PTSD and substance abuse, and I understand the demons and know where that mindset is. And you really need to think about what's more important than your own selfishness, but sometimes you can't.
And this issue of guns, Ryan, obviously veterans, people familiar with guns, comfortable with them, maybe part of their identity owning a gun. The general advice, Heidi was saying, is to be separated from your gun when you're having suicidal ideation, contemplating suicide. Is that something you think for your fellow veterans that's always an option?
It could be an option, but to understand the culture, you send somebody to a combat zone where that weapon is attached to them 24/7 for the entire deployment, whether it's 7 months to a year, that is their defense. So they cling to it. They feel vulnerable without it.
Well, Heidi, let's talk about the latest incarnation here. You said it started with a rubber band holding that picture on the veteran's firearm. What is it now? What is you're kicking off a new thing now?
Yeah, so as I thought about how this project might progress, I did some research by, again, talking to veterans, as I have every step of the way, to ask them if they could help me to come up with something that would work to be placed on the firearm. So we looked at several different types of products, and I came across a company called Gunskins. And Gunskins is a company who offers, their skins or adhesives of camo that go on firearms. So I reached out to them, and they were incredibly generous and excited about collaborating. And so together with Gunskins, we came up with four camouflage patterns, and they embedded our logo into those patterns. So on our website, veterans can go to the website, to the order form, which will be available on Friday. They choose the pattern that they want, and we're hoping the logo itself might be a reminder of the mission, and that might be enough for some people. But we encourage people on the website to upload a relevant, a personally relevant, meaningful photo. And when we get their order, we have that picture printed. We take their chosen pattern, we put it all together, and we send it out to them free of charge. So we're starting at first with handguns and pistols, just based on statistics that these are the most frequently used firearms and suicides.
So tell us the website, Heidi, and I understand there's a benefit concert. Can you briefly tell us about that?
Yeah, our website is www.covermeveterans.org, and we are having a benefit concert on Friday. We're incredibly honored to have a veteran, J.P. Lane, perform. He lost both legs in Afghanistan during his deployment and really fought back against all odds to not only walk but to be very successful, and is now a musician. And he offered to play this benefit concert and asked if he could invite his buddy, Lee Greenwood.
Wow.
Yeah. So that was really exciting. So on Friday, J.P. Lane and Lee Greenwood are performing a benefit concert for us in Green Bay at the Meyer Theater.
All right. Well, we'll leave it there for now. Good luck with this effort. Heidi, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us.
And Ryan, thanks to you as well.
Thank you, sir.
I've been talking to Sergeant Ryan Bodwin. He served with the U.S. Marine Corps in Iraq, 1999 to 2006. He was deployed 2004, 2005. Heidi Sigmund, psychologist. She works with veterans diagnosed with PTSD. We've been talking about this initiative, the nonprofit group Cover Me Veterans.
Coming up, we'll talk to a reporter about the new Pokemon Go app and the security concerns that are coming up with the game's popularity. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Pokemon Go has become a national sensation since its release last week. Walking down the street, you're likely to see both kids and adults walking around staring at their phones.
That's because they're trying to capture the little monsters known as Pokemon that are appearing alongside real-life objects as they play the game.
But now cybersecurity experts warn that signing up for the mobile game can mean giving all the information in your Gmail account over to the game developer. Part of signing up is using your Google account information to create your Pokemon account.
We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you playing Pokemon Go, or are your kids playing it? Are you worried about some of the security concerns and other concerns that have been raised with this new app that's making billions of dollars of difference for a company? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post, by the way, on the Central Time Facebook page.
Haley Sukayama joins us now. She's a technology reporter for the Washington Post. Haley, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So judging by all the people in my local neighborhood park last night, I feel like probably no one has not heard of the game or is not playing it, but I'm sure there's someone out there. So let's start with, how does it work? What does it look like?
Sure. So this is a mobile game. It's the first in the Pokemon franchise, which you may remember had a big craze sort of in the mid-90s, certainly when I was growing up, and has really stuck with people, particularly of my age. I'm 30, so, in the 20s and 30s. And what you do is you can go out and be a real-life Pokemon trainer using your smartphone. The phone will buzz when you're near a Pokemon, and then you can call it up on your phone and actually, with your finger on the screen, fling balls toward the little monsters to catch them and collect them.
Right, and the game has taken off. Like, I guess I've never seen anything take off like this for an app. Why has it gone so viral so fast?
Well, I think it's a combination of factors, right? I think Pokemon is a very popular franchise. It's particularly popular with the people who are on their phones the most, and I think the technology, the augmented reality technology, which is sort of like a more advanced version of what they used to, for example, paint the first downline on a football field, right, on a television broadcast, sort of blending that digital and real world, just fit really well with the sort of exploratory nature of this franchise. So sort of a you know, a nice combination of factors brought together. Also, it's summer, so, you know, we're all looking for a distraction.
Right, and I guess distraction is one word, and maybe we'll get to that later, because it can be kind of distracting for people, to say the least. But there have been some bumps in the road for Nintendo, and one of these issues that have come up, aside from distraction, is cybersecurity. What kind of concerns are we seeing there?
Sure. So when this app was first released, and actually, still, this is still true, it just so happened that the developer who made the app, which is a company called Niantic that worked with Nintendo, allowed basically for the app to ask for all access to all of your Google account, which means that, you know, it can do basically everything but change your password, delete your account, or pay on your behalf. Now, I do caution that Niantic is, they're pushing out a fix. I know that they've already pushed out a fix to early testers, and so I anticipate that they'll get this locked down pretty soon. But for right now, they do have access to all the information in your Google account, though they've promised not to use it.
And I think you said that the fix that's going to be coming down the pike is going to be on the consumer side, not so much on the company side. So do you have any idea what people might have to do?
Well, it should be as simple, actually, as just updating your app and signing back in, because on the company side, they will kind of change the way that they look at the Google account. So it should be okay. You know, we'll obviously have to see as they update, you know, how they execute it. But you should just have to update your app. So keep an eye out.
I know that this has been something that has brought the app and the designers under fire, the company under fire a little bit here. One person you talked to, I think, used the word epic in describing the failure here to notice that there was a security breach. Why do security breaches this big happen? Why are these holes when it should have been vetted properly?
Well, sure. So I do want to be clear. There's been no breach yet. Nobody's actually gone in and taken the information.
Right.
The risk is that they could go in and take the information. You know, I think a lot of times developers, you know, they're trying to get all the components of the game together, and probably what happened is somebody, I mean, this is not comforting by any means, but if I had to guess, knowing what I know about app development, I would guess that somebody just checked the wrong box of how much permission they wanted for the app. And certainly just because of the way that our laws are set up, you know, it's kind of up to the discretion of the developer how much access they ask for. So, you know, it's my guess is they just hit the wrong check mark.
So, Haley, should we be playing the game now, or should we be waiting until the fix comes along?
You know, I mean, that's sort of it's a personal preference thing. I admit that I am still playing, even though I know the security risks, which is maybe not the best model to follow. But certainly, if you're very concerned about it, you know, you can hold off. A fix is coming, so you won't totally miss out on the craze. And, you know, right now, I admit I myself am putting my information in Niantic's hands and hoping that they don't get hacked. So that is a risk that everybody kind of has to make for themselves, I think.
We're talking to technology reporter Haley Tsukayama right now about security concerns and also some safety concerns surrounding the new Pokemon Go mobile game. And Haley, my family is super into this. We all downloaded it last night. And I did notice that there's a couple times, you know, that the game tells you to be aware of your surroundings. But is it enough? Is that little warning that you should still be aware of what's going on around you enough to keep people safe?
Well, you know, I think it is very easy to get engrossed in this game, and I think it's easy to lose your common sense a little bit, right? I know I have when I've been chasing after something and stepped over the curb and gone, wait, I'm about to walk into the street. So what I would advise is that you hunt in groups so that you can all be looking out for each other. I do think that the game could do a better job of, you know, just maybe even they remind you at the beginning to be aware of your surroundings, but it would be good to, you know, maybe every 10 minutes, 20 minutes, just remind people to look up, you know, be a little more careful. They're also going to have an accessory, a $35 accessory that will buzz when there's a Pokemon nearby, so that you don't always have to be staring at your phone. But, you know, whether anybody wants to buy that is probably another question.
Let's take a caller now. We've got Tim with us in West Bend. Tim, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, thanks.
Yeah, so it actually started out as kind of a cute thing for us because one of the Pokemon hotspots is in my front yard.
Wow. And,
about 2 days ago, we had a three sets of teenagers at different times come through and staring at their phone. The first one, my wife was really like, what is going on here? And so we come to find out that there's obviously a Pokemon thing for the GPS in our front yard.
Wow.
Didn't really think too much of it until this morning when my wife called me hysterically because a teenage kid holding up their phone was driving. They drove up our driveway and onto our lawn.
And
they almost hit our 3-year-old daughter.
That's terrifying.
Now these GPS locations, it bothers me that they set it at random when there's other fail-safes, because I'm actually a senior application developer for Northwestern Mutual. So another company called Ingress has another similar type game, but they use actual national monuments and memorial stones and public GPS locations, so they avoid you going into people's yards and trespassing.
Right, and I didn't know the extent of that. I know that some places are landmarks. I've heard about the White House outside the fence being one of the spots, but how common is that, Haley, that it might be just somebody's yard, and what does that do for safety? That's a really scary story.
Yeah, that is a really scary story, and I'm so sorry you had to go through that. So actually, Ingress is made by this same company that worked with Nintendo called Niantic, and it uses more or less the same maps. But the difference, of course, is that in Ingress, you're standing by points. There's nothing moving around, and so that's why we're seeing people walking onto private property, because there are things to chase, right, in this game. So they're using the same points, but there are things to chase in this game, so that's why we're seeing people trespass. You know, I think Niantic is, they're working on going through all the complaints that they've seen. They're trying to figure out what the best way to marry these two things, to marry privacy and the exploratory nature of the game are. I think it's just going to be kind of a work in progress. And I would hope that players would be more responsible than what we just heard.
Right, Tim. Well, thank you for calling and sharing that. And thank goodness your daughter was okay. And let's go next to Katie in Burlington. Hi, Katie.
Well, the only reason I know about this app is because I asked my 19-year-old son if he wanted to go for a walk with me a couple days ago. And he said yes, and I was like, wow. Well, and then he goes, well, because there's some Pokemon out on this other road, and we would go by there. And he was almost willing to keep on walking. So there is some good to the game. I guess I could see where you could get into accidents. So, but walking was great.
Right. Well, Katie, thanks so much for that. A 19-year-old going for a walk, looking for Pokemon, wants to keep going. That seems like a positive.
Absolutely. If you look at the step count on my own phone, it's shot up since this game was released.
Maybe they need to partner with Fitbit or something like that.
There you go.
Get your steps in. Well, we're talking about the new Pokemon Go mobile game, talking about some security concerns right now with the Google sign-in, looking at when that might get fixed. Also talking about safety concerns about Pokemon Go. We're talking with reporter Haley Tsukayama right now from The Washington Post.
And we'd like to talk to you at 800-642-1234. Have you tried this thing, Pokemon Go? Are you wondering what all the fuss is about? Are your kids, your grandkids doing it? What's the experience been like? Are you worried about online security and personal safety? Some of the stories we've heard there. What do you think about this idea of augmented reality games? Today, Pokemon. Tomorrow, who knows what? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue our conversation and get to your calls in just a little bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're picking up our discussion now with Haley Sukayama of The Washington Post.
We're talking about Pokemon Go. This new app just came out last week. It's all over the place, and it's raising concerns about cybersecurity and about personal safety. People walk around, driving around, very distracted by it. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you tried this? Have your kids? Is it fun? Is it motivating for people to get out and walk? Do you have some of these concerns? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll go to Jason now. Jason joining us from Waukesha. Jason, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing well. I actually run a Nintendo website called NintendoWire.com, and we've been reporting on this pretty much since it started. We live right in the heart of downtown Waukesha, and since the app started pretty much on Android and iOS, there have been at least 100 people outside of our window every single moment of the day. We're
wow.
talking midnight, 11 o'clock, there's people out there. So it's kind of a double-edged sword because there are so many nice people out there, so many people mm-hmm. that are just completely into the app. But I think starting last night, we started to get the drunk people. We started getting the people yelling.
Hmm.
And I think that's going to get old pretty quickly. But by and large, a majority of the people playing are super, super nice people.
Jason, thanks for that. That provides a definite snapshot into what's going on. And Haley, I mean, it is interesting. Like I said, when I was at the park, everyone in the park was doing the app very clearly. They were wandering through bogs and walking around erratically or running after things. I mean, is it something to think about? I mean, did Nintendo think about the disruption? Because I think in some cases this is disrupting a little bit, not to overstate it, but the fabric of society, the way that we move around in public spaces.
Yeah, I mean, I think probably they're victims of their own success in a certain way, right? They probably thought about it a little bit, but thought, well, you know, it won't be too big a deal. There won't be too many people, but it is an incredible amount of people. And I think, you know, maybe they just need to put a little etiquette reminder in the beginning of the app, and, you know, we can police each other, too, as players and say, hey, you know, don't be a jerk. Remember that there are non-players around.
Right. Jason, thanks a lot for that. And Mike is next in Madison. Hi, Mike.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
I wanted to start off with just one simple point that people are still forgetting is that the game is still in a beta stage. It's not at its first release version yet, so it's mm-hmm. really just kind of testing and tweaking as things go along. So is the security flaws and things like that that exist, nothing has been really tightened up as of yet. Should it have been done already? Sure, but they're also working in coordination with Google, which has not given the app permission to view anything other than the pieces of data that they need. So the app, while it asks for permissions for everything, it doesn't actually give permissions right away. And then the second thing is like somebody commented before, there's a game called Ingress, which is also made by Niantic. And the problem, I think, between that and there, because all of the portals from Ingress were converted to Pokestops and gyms in Pokemon, we are now dealing with a much younger audience. There's a lot of people that are younger, more immature, more irresponsible that are now playing this game. And I think that's part of the cause, you know, like somebody driving into somebody's driveway and up their yard. I mean, adults typically wouldn't do that. We're just dealing with a lot larger audience because Pokemon is wider circulation as well as a younger audience.
Good points. Thanks, thanks, Mike. And touching first, Haley, on the beta phase, he says that the game is still in. How is that affecting things?
Well, you know, I think he's right. It's also kind of a double-edged sword for developers, right? It's hard to test a game that relies on a community without releasing it to a pretty broad community. But it is true that they are still tweaking things. As he said, they're not even to version 1.0 yet, right? They're still trying to signal to people that it's a pretty early build. That said, you know, if you do release it to a general audience, you have to be mindful of, you know, what that general audience might do. So, you know, maybe they should have taken a couple more beats to think about it, but he is right in that it should get better over time.
We're talking with Haley Sukayama from the Washington Post, talking about the wildly popular Pokemon Go app, which it seems like lots of people have cottoned onto very quickly. And we're wondering, if you're playing it right now, are you worried about some of the security issues that could be in play? Are you still playing it despite those? And what about safety? Do you think that people are being safe when they're playing with it. And what do you think is going to happen in terms of augmented reality? If this is the wave of the future, what does it look like and how do we interact with it? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And Haley, let's talk more about that augmented reality technology. Do you think that this game is one of the first that we're going to see, and this is maybe just the beginning?
Well, I think the success of this game is certainly going to prompt a lot of copycats. And I think, you know, it'll be really interesting to see how people take this technology, you know, moving forward. I think people are already, you know, trying to figure out who might be next, who might be able to come up with the next successful game like this. There's a franchise called Skylanders, which also, you know, has a lot of little characters that you collect, and so people are wondering if maybe they'll jump into this too. I certainly think that this proves that augmented reality technology can be fun in a game and can have broad appeal, and so I definitely think, you know, it's going to generate a lot more interest, and hopefully we'll see more thoughtful products.
When you're talking about thoughtful, what do you want those companies to do better that maybe Nintendo didn't get perfect right off the bat?
Well, I think, you know, certainly in choosing locations, you know, it probably would have been good to maybe kind of go through. They did basically use the same database from Ingress, this other game that we're talking about, for this Pokemon game, and it probably would have been good to go through and kind of weed out, think about the audience a little more, weed out some of the stops where maybe we don't want people. Of course, here in D.C., we've heard from the Holocaust Museum said, you know, we don't want people hunting Pokemon in here. We've heard that from Arlington Cemetery. You know, these are things that, you know, probably could have been addressed earlier. And, you know, they could also, I would like to see future developers think carefully about, you know, choosing locations and then also maybe reach out to those locations to make sure that they're okay with it. And, you know, that you could easily see this working with, you know, local businesses who want to be a Pokestop so that they can draw more customers. So it doesn't have to be an adversarial relationship. And I think if there's more thought ahead of time, then it could be really beneficial.
We'll take another caller now. We've got Marcy with us next in Milwaukee. Hi, Marcy.
Hi there. How are you doing?
Good.
Well, I'd like to bring up a fact that nobody's really brought up yet, and it's the fact that Pokemon Go has turned into a drinking game for college students.
Well, I did not know that. How did you find out about that, Marcy?
Well, college students can turn anything into a drinking game, really.
That was a safe bet. Fair enough.
What the big draw is here is if you go on Facebook. Now, I'm from Wisconsin, and we're pretty out in the middle of nowhere here, but it's really popular in Madison, Milwaukee, and Chicago, where kids are getting together and going bar hopping, dressing up like they're like Ash Ketchum and stuff and Misty from Pokemon, going out to the bars and then, you know, drinking quite a bit, and then going out to parks and around the city trying to catch Pokemon together.
Wow.
And it's turned into quite a camaraderie. You meet interesting people, I guess.
Right. Well, that part of it, I mean, so it's not exactly a black and white issue. It's Marcy, you know, is talking about college students going out drinking. If they're being rowdy, that's one thing. If they're using it to get together and people getting out, getting together. But I don't know, Haley, what do you think? Is this a net positive here?
You know, I'd like to think of it as a net positive because I do enjoy the game. And actually, I often, you know, I don't talk to strangers in public. But when I was out with my husband the other night, we talked to a lot of people, met a couple of really great people. So I think, you know, right now we sort of have to depend on the players to be mature and responsible, which obviously not everybody is. But, you know, I would hope that this does create kind of a fun community and a fun way to meet people.
We'll leave it there. Haley, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That was Haley Tsukuyama, technology reporter for The Washington Post, and she joined us to talk about the future of mobile games and also security concerns concerning the new Pokemon Go app.
What a world we live in.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.